My name is Mary Andrews, and I'm sitting here in DeVue Park with Mr. Vincent Keller, who has been superintendent of DeVue Park from 1934 through 1975. I'm interviewing Mr. Keller on behalf of Friends of DeVue, a local citizens group formed in the spring of 1977 to recreate interest in the city's park. And after a few investigations, I was given Mr. Keller's name, and he seems to be the very person who's been around to see the maturation and some of the highlights and some of the disappointments as a result of working here in the park. So, Mr. Keller, could you please tell us a little bit about yourself, first of all?
Yes, I was employed as with the L&N Railroad as a locomotive fireman from 1922 to 1929. When I was laid off because of the Depression, I was able to find work at other jobs until I went to work for the Park Board in the spring of 1932 as a laborer. There were several projects in progress working in DeVue Park under government relief agencies since 1929, such as roads, beautification, stone walls, tree planting, and general park maintenance. All rock for construction work was quarried in the old rock quarry on West Covington Road across from Prisoners Lake in the park.
You mentioned that you were a laborer. What kind of laborers did they have? What were the men? I assume they were men. Probably they didn't hire women then. What did the men do here in the park?
Well, they would trim shrubbery, plant shrubbery, trees. They would, at that time we had playgrounds in Covington that we took care of. We would take those up and down, up and put them up in the summer and take them down in the fall, and then repair them at this park in Goble, at the Scheller House in Goble Park. But all our other work was just cutting grass, mowing grass in the hillsides, and keeping the park in generally pretty good, healthy condition.
Okay, I'd like to back up just a bit and ask you a little bit about the DeVues. William P. DeVue did give the park to the city, well, Charles too, the two brothers, gave the park to the city in the early 1900s, and I wondered if you knew anything about the DeVue family that you could share with us.
No, I didn't know much about the DeVue family. The only one I really knew was William P. DeVue, who lived over in Cincinnati in the West End, owned a lot of property, and as I understand it, he lived in the front room of a stable where the back room was, his horse was kept. And he would ride around the streets on that horse and saddle, even ride up here in the park and look over things occasionally.
And that was the day of the automobile, too, because he didn't die.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
1937. Yeah. He died in 1937. And I guess I was about the only one, other than that I know of, that went over to see him and had a difficult time getting across the bridge to go up and see where he was laid out, up on Court Street somewhere. But he was a very distinguished looking gentleman. He was good looking.
He was good looking,
had a
huh?
Nice white beard that they cleaned up.
Oh, nice. Interesting.
But that's about all I know of the DeVues.
I did hear one story where he never owned an automobile. He refused to buy one.
No, he never rode in one. I don't believe he ever rode in one.
Oh, my. Yeah, all of his money. So he and his brother donated the park to the city. Now, do you know why they did this, or on what grounds did they give the park?
Well, just from hearsay, it was too much of a... it was too much property to take care of and to pay taxes on. So they thought if they could give it to the city and be free of taxes, that would help their estate and relieve them of duties of this property up here.
I see. But now he did take a lot of interest in the park itself, didn't he? Buy some trees and plant them himself?
Oh, yeah. He took, after it was turned over to the city, why they had the park board over here and also the trustees of the First National Bank in Covington. And he was very much interested, and he wanted them to do something for the park, and he planted a lot of trees up here, which go out to the children's home, the ones coming here into Kenton Hills, and generally all around the park. All these cedar trees and all that pine trees, they were all under his suggestion.
And then Charles, William's brother, was the first superintendent of the park, is that? Do you know anything about that?
No, I don't know too much about it, but I never heard anything like that. But
well, he was a young man. I mean, he died. He was 19. It was 1922 or something. So it wouldn't have been a very long amount of time.
No.
That's true. Okay. You mentioned before that some improvements were made in the park through some government programs during as an attempt to come out of the Depression. Could you explain some of those in greater detail for us?
In 1934, the superintendent of parks resigned in September, and in October I was appointed to succeed him. And on the 25th of that month, I moved into the three-room cottage used for the help who worked for the DeVues from the old across from the old DeVue residence. In the next 3 or 4 years, I did a lot of remodeling inside and outside of the house to make it more livable.
And that house is being used today, isn't it, by the present keeper of the park?
The director of the park uses it as his residence.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Having knowledge of projects under construction in the park at that time, I went on to complete them and run, and in the meantime, I had plans of my own for further projects. As two cellar houses, two restrooms, drinking fountains, band shell, widening of the bridle trails, which were extended to approximately 15 miles. Guardrails on each turn were of locust poles and posts. All of the joists used in the cellar houses were from the trees cut in the park, as was the bridges on the golf course and the bridle paths. Out of the ends and pieces and ends from these poles and joists, we built some picnic tables and benches and signs, which were all my own idea. The tables didn't last long because they were old wood to begin with, and they deteriorated pretty fast.
But it was an attempt, wasn't it? I mean,
yeah.
That's what's important. Yeah.
We had at that time from 200 to 300 men every day from October to spring employed under PWA, CWA, and KEA. All the projects were started in 37 and finished in 1942.
Could you describe what WPA, CWA, and KEA?
Well,
what are these programs? Do you know?
WPA was Works Progress Agency, and the CWA was Civil Works Agency, and the other KEA was Kentucky Emergency Association.
Okay. So these three programs together financed the salaries of 200 to 300 people?
Yeah, which was anywhere from, according to your family and that sort of thing, that they were paid anywhere from $6 to $12 a week.
Oh, my.
Yes.
Did you supervise all of these people?
Yes.
All of them?
Mm-hmm. We had to, I had to lay out projects for them, like building some stone walls at places that were dangerous, like around the lake, and behind the band shell, extending the wall here on Western Avenue, walls along Ludlow Road, walls on a golf course, a shelter house on the golf course, and and putting up that road alongside the tennis course, which runs dead into Sleepy Hollow Road. Yeah, it was kind of quite a job, and of course we had timekeepers, we had a man who distributed tools, so many tools at each project that was working, and along with wheelbarrows, picks and shovels, and at that time they would do some work.
Yeah. But they, yeah.
now it's a different story.
Yeah.
So
were these people skilled? Did they learn? They were trained,
yeah,
right?
Oh, yeah. We had anywhere from piano tuners to telegraphers and very skilled mechanics.
Hmm.
All kinds. Railroad employees, railroad brakemen, firemen, engineers. Very skilled.
Hmm.
Carpenters,
hmm.
Cement, rock finishers,
hmm.
rock masons. And, just about every kind.
Mm.
And they didn't get any more money for that skill than just the regular labor did.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, it was mostly the size of his family and his needs, I guess, and whatever, that was the scale they paid.
Mm. But that was also the time when the most was done in the park.
Oh, yeah.
It makes
yeah.
sense
mm-hmm.
that they had all the people.
Yeah.
How about the forestry here? Did they also care for the trees and the?
Well, not too much grass? Because that was such a big project, and we didn't have the proper tools to go into that function, and we just left that alone. Of course, we did thin out a whole lot, cut trees out, and cleared the different places in the park for picnic areas and whatever. In 55 to 65, I was instrumental in getting three modern restrooms with flush-type toilets, tile walls, red brick on the outside, with galvanized iron on the roofs to prevent vandalism. This project was paid for by the funds of the DeVue Estate Trustees from the First National Bank of Covington, Kentucky, at a cost of about $130,000. In December 1945, the old DeVue home was damaged by fire. The house was occupied by Wallace Rich, an officer with the Stored Ironworks of Covington. Cause of the fire was a live coal rolled out of the grate onto the floor, causing extensive damage. Later the next year, 1946, George Lyons, the city manager of Covington, contracted with John Hemmer to remodel the house, which became the museum. The director of the museum was Ellis Crawford, who was well qualified and knew Mr. William Barringer well, gave a lot of his material for the museum. Mr. Barringer was a big game hunter and fisherman. taxidermist, of which a lot of his work can be seen in the museum today. In 1955, Mrs. Wallace of the Stewart Iron Works in Covington gave the park board about $1,500 for playground equipment in the park, which was park employees erected and is still standing.
Was there any playground equipment before that?
No.
None?
No, there wasn't any playground equipment at all up here. All they had was a few picnic sites, which they set on the ground to eat and that sort of thing.
Okay.
So with that money, we purchased 5 slides, 5 merry-go-rounds, 3 monkey bars, 5 sets of 9-seat swings, which are still standing today and used. In about 1960, the estate built a building known as a memorial to the DeVues, which is rented for meetings and social functions. In 62, DeVue Estate built a 60-foot garage to store and keep our equipment out of the weather. They also purchased 75 7-foot picnic tables, 28 cast iron grills, tractors, trucks, and other equipment used in the park, which did not cost the city of Covington anything. From then on, the work was routine maintenance in the park.
Okay. I'd like to back up just a little bit. During the WPA program, wasn't the band shell made?
Yes, it was made through that time from 37 to 42.
Now, that was one of the highlights of the park, wasn't it? The band shell itself. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about some of the activities that centered around it.
Well, the band shell was finished in 1939, and they held concerts sponsored by the businessmen of the city of Covington. They had good entertainers that come from all over the United States, and especially the biggest main attractions we had was from the old Lookout House in Fort Wright. We had like Sophie Tucker and Jimmy Durante, and the Reds won the ball, the pennant series rather, in 1939-40, and they came up here, and then they had photographed the area in this place, and the electric company did the photographing, and they estimated a crowd of about 45,000 people in that area.
Was this common? I mean, for the band shell occasions, they would attract that many people?
Oh, yes, from all over. You got them from everywhere, as far as Lexington, Hamilton, Ohio, Dayton, Ohio, all over. This place was full. You couldn't walk through that crowd on the band shell.
Hmm.
You had to go around it, too.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, naturally, I was down there working with the band, setting out one thing and another and helping them with the acts or shows, you know, sort of like a stagehand.
Yeah.
But it sure was wonderful.
They also had some sing-alongs, didn't they?
Then after the acts, which were generally about 5, they would, they had a big canvas screen and a projector, and they made signs of the different names, words of the songs that to be sung, and they were flashed on the screen, and everybody would join in the sing-along, which an organ accompanied the singers.
Did they have concession stands at that time?
Yeah, they had one concession run by Ben Keyes at the top of the hill, and of course over there at the top of Montague Hill between the Park Road and the road that goes to Ludlow, there was another quite large cellar house where soft drinks and candy and everything was dispensed there.
Did they sell beer then?
No,
no beer in the park.
No.
Huh?
This Ben Keyes, the concessionaire, he didn't want one beer in there. However, the patrons, they brought their own beer in and sit there and drink beer and watch a concert, and it got to be pretty.
Who sponsored or who financed the concerts?
The merchants of the city of Covington each put up so much. There was Eilerman's, Coppins, and Electric Company, and the banks, and a couple of banks, and I guess that's about it. About five or six of them.
Well, what happened? Why did these concerts stop?
Well, yeah, after the war, they tried to have three or four of them, but the expense of hiring acts was so great, and it didn't bring in enough business for the businessmen to sponsor these things because of the money. And where they had two or three of them, the kids and the crowd just got so rowdy that they wouldn't let the actors go on. They'd throw pop bottles, they threw rocks and pine cones and anything that they had in their hands to disrupt the concerts, the acts. So that's when they decided to leave it, because I think at that time it would cost each merchant about $700 to put on these acts, which at that time they cut to about three or four. And when this happened, why, they just forgot about it. And since then, it's been more or less vacant. We've had a lot of Mother's Day masses put on by the cathedral in Covington. We had a lot of Protestant denominations, different churches would come up and hold evening services. We had the WCPO at one time had a concert of record playing, you know, this, what do you call it? But that didn't attract anything, so that was about all until the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra came up here quite a few years ago, and they would have their symphony, which is very good and very very nice, and of course it attracted a different class of people, and they appreciated every minute of it. Really good.
Another means of recreation that I've heard in reference to DeVue Park is a bridle trail that was here a long time ago. Is that correct?
Yeah, they had bridle trails a long time ago, but they were only like dog paths. And so I worked up this project to widen that, which we had anywhere from 60 to 80 men every day on that job, picking up whiting. All work was done by hand. They'd pick up the rocks, branches, and they built these bridges across these little creeks and gullies. And
that was during the WPA
program? Yeah, during the Depression.
Yeah.
And and there would be a lot of people riding. Boy, there was loads of them all the time through the summer.
Okay, and what happened to that program then?
Well, this woman who, Mrs. Diamond, who run the Sunnyside Riding Club, I guess got tired of it. And like everything else, people would ride their horses downtown or somewhere and then tie them to a post and leave them there while they were in a saloon, and somebody else would pick them up and they'd go home, I guess.
Can't blame her for that.
No, so then they sold it to a fellow by the name of Del Vaughn. And he ran it for a while, and he got tired of it. So then he sold it to a fellow by the name of Meter, Ed Meter, who had quite a few slot machines. And he also run a book here in Covington. And he run it for a while, and it caught on fire and burned up, and that was the end of it.
Okay, do you have any idea when that was? Was that around the wartime, too?
No, I can't.
Was that later?
I can't think when the fire happened.
Well, what happened to the trail since then?
Well, they're just growing up, Nobody used them. They thought of making nature trails out of it, but there just wasn't enough money to keep them clear, and a lot of people would probably be afraid to walk on the trail, mm-hmm. and I'm sure they would now. Mm-hmm. Conditions mm-hmm. that things are today.
Yeah.
I don't think even I'd want to ride, walk them.
Did you, you not only didn't have the equipment, but then you didn't have the labor to
no,
keep them up either,
that's
I suppose.
Right, yeah.
That was one of the problems
yeah.
there. Now, the golf course and the tennis courts have been in existence for some time in the
yeah,
park, too,
since,
haven't they?
They built a court. I guess the tennis golf course was finished in about 27. And a tennis court is older than that. They used to have a old, a real old house that the Montague, who had a farm from the golf where the golf course clubhouse stands now, they had a farm all the way down to the Southern Railroad Bridge in that area.
Hmm.
And that house burned in 1929. However, the Montagues moved from there a long, many years ago. As a matter of fact, I lived on 43rd Street as a kid, and they moved, his parents and his son, Montagues, moved about two doors from us.
Hmm.
And he told me a lot of about this part.
Hmm.
He was a more or less a wagon and hearse and buggy painter, and and he had a job on the B&O Railroad, and he had a leg amputated by the railroad cars, and that was about the end of him. It wasn't a few years later why he died.
Getting back to the golf course and the tennis courts, why is it that they're still functional and some other things have fallen within the park? Do you have any reason for that?
The golf course is pretty much self-sustaining, but the tennis courts weren't. And of course, the city provided just enough money to keep five courts open. Where there's seven of them up there, all they had was five courts.
Oh.
And they could maintain those pretty well. That was my job too, to see that they were constructed, probably all dirt courts at that time, and it was quite a job from the standing there in the winter time and then renovate them again in the spring, see.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite a big job to do.
Hmm. Now you said the golf course is self-sustaining. There's a fee to play golf.
Oh yeah, yeah. You pay greens fees, and well, that's about all.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that would help, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
What about a spring? Could you? I guess this was during the time of the WPA administration. There was a spring on the golf course. You showed me.
Oh, it was a spring house.
A spring house.
There was a big you can call it a well or a spring. It was about 65, 70 feet deep. And they wanted, well, that's when DeVue said, well, let's put a top over it and preserve it and keep it the way it should be. And of course, the spring leaked and the water wasn't any good to drink. Old well or spring, whatever you wanted to call it, that would leak and it would fill up with water, and which was no good to drink. So the park board, under my supervision, put pipe water from the barn on down to the field to the spring house, which there were automatic close-off valves for drinking water.
and vandalism prevented further use of that. After about a year, they would just destroy the fountains and the faucets, and they just did away with them, closed them up.
Mm. Is it true that William P. DeVue did want the people of Covington to be able to drink from the well?
Oh yeah, DeVue wanted the people to drink from the well to keep them from spending money for a soft drink.
Yeah, I admire his wisdom there, I tell you. Oh, it's interesting. Could you tell us about the rock quarry? That seems to be quite significant in terms of this park.
And yeah, they...
Now, the rock quarry was started even before...
Yeah, it was, according to Mr. DeVue, he said, that quarry was started by whom, I don't know, and he didn't say, but it was around 1884.
Oh, my.
And but when they gave the park to the city, why, that's when they really went into it to build, to get enough rock out of there to build these roads. But however, I don't know who did the quarrying, maybe the help that DeVue had that would require rock and stone on these roads through the woods for a horse and buggy.
So all the rock used here in the park was taken from the park itself,
yeah,
right?
Mm-hmm.
All the roads and the benches?
Yeah.
The stone benches?
Yeah. Walls.
And then can you tell us a little bit about Prisoner's Lake, how that came to be as a result of the
Well, fire? Like I said, it was the offfall, that is the dirt between the rock, layers of rock, was hauled over there by carts on rails, which was like a railroad car. And they would load it there across the road from this hollow or valley, and then they would, by gravity, it would roll on over to the valley, and eventually the valley filled up, and the water from the Park Service in that area created a lake.
Hmm.
And that's how it
is. And then the city stocked it?
No, the city didn't stock it. The state stocked it.
Oh.
But that was a hard job to do, too, get them to do something for us. But I knew the game warden up here pretty well, and he was instrumental in getting some stock fish up here.
Oh, that's good.
But,
what kind of groups use the park in the park's heyday? Were there Boy Scouts up here? Or?
Yeah, there's Boy Scouts up here, and as a matter of fact, out here where we're sitting now near the memorial building, this whole area, they used to have as high as 1,500 to 2,000 Boy Scouts, and they were camped all over this area.
Oh, my.
Right where we're sitting here on this little island-like or parking lot, over and all over out here. Then they would have, I guess at the last night or two before they broke up, they would have a big campfire down here in the near the building.
How about Girl Scouts? Do they spend time
Yeah,
up here?
Girl Scouts had a day camp over here off the left of the Children's Home Road, which is behind the museum, and until all these hippies and all this other vandalism and beer-drinking outfit come up there in the park and block the roads and obscene language and everything else that the Girl Scouts just abandoned this place.
When did this this trend come about, where the what you called hippies came into the park? When?
I would say about 1970, perhaps.
So just in the last 69, few years?
69, 70, 69, yeah.
Huh? So that the Girl Scouts were using the park 10 years, or maybe 15 years ago in the
60s? Oh yeah, let's see, yeah, 20 years, I guess.
Yeah.
20 years, from all over, Ludlow and Bromley, Latonia, Erlanger, DeCourcy.
What about the schools, the Covington schools? Have they used this
Well, yes,
much?
They would, each class, maybe right before vacation time, each school would bring maybe one or two or three classes up for a day outing in the park.
Mm-hmm.
They brought their own lunch, and of course the concession house was open at that time, and some kids would buy soft drinks and that sort of thing, but most of them had their lunches, and they were supervised real well by teachers, and they really had a good time.
Yeah. Well, when did the concession stands close?
When the concerts closed?
Same time, huh?
When was it about?
Yeah. So vandalism is, you think, is the main source of a lot of the problems up here in the park.
Oh, definitely.
Plus the short shortage of labor.
Yeah.
And also the lack of money
put
into the park. So.
Well, and years ago, too, when they had these school picnics and that, or even big family reunions, which were quite a few of them, these motorcycles and horseback riders would ride right through the crowd, scare them, see how close they could come to them before the people moved. They had either moved or got hit, one or the other.
Well, what do you think could be done to prevent that? I'm sure you've
thought
of it.
Good police.
Park police, do you suggest, or does it doesn't
any
matter?
Any kind of police, no. Any kind of police. They finally broke, they said, told me at meetings that it couldn't be broke up, but just in the past couple of years, they did break it up.
Hmm.
And it just showed that they didn't want to, I guess, or didn't want to be bothered with. I don't think the city of Covington cared too much about having this park anyway. So, because they never did want to spend or give us the needed equipment and men that we needed to do a job, they were reluctant to. We had to fight with them all the time, and it was very disgusting, discouraging.
So it seems to me that you've been through the highlights of this park as well.
Definitely,
as from the real downfall.
Yes, I've seen the best of this park. And
I guess I
can say that I was very instrumental in getting it, because I was raised that way of camping and outdoors, and I liked it, and I did everything that was possible to promote things up there.
Okay, well, could you tell us, Mr. Keller, why you decided to retire, or why you're no longer employed here?
Good labor in about 1972 was very hard to employ, to have them do a day's work. All they looked for was quitting time and payday. And after a couple of years, I decided to retire, which I did in October 1975.
Hmm.
It was very disgusting, discouraging, and they wouldn't let you employ the help that you wanted. You had to take the help that they sent you, and they just wouldn't work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just wouldn't work.
Okay, well, if you could have any dream for this park now come true, what is it that you would like to see happen here?
I would like to see a 24 or at least 18-hour police protection, and then encourage these people to come back for reunions, family picnics, and perhaps have some sort of a concert a couple of times a year at the band shell, and to promote that sort of thing. Because years and years ago, family groups who had picnics or reunions would come up here at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning just to save a table. And some of them over here where the Girl Scout day camp was, or is now yet, by the children's home, they'd stay all night over there.
Mm-hmm.
We had social clubs from these different saloons that would invite all of their customers, women and children, and they really had a crowd. 300-400 people.
Mm-hmm. So you think police protection then?
Yes.
would be the first important step in reviving the park.
As I said, they told me, well, if you couldn't do it with police. I said, well, you know, it's funny that down here at Big Bone, Lick State Park, you can go in there, but you can't show any beer cans, you can't show any beer bottles or whiskey bottles.
Yeah.
You know, anything like they did up here in DeVue Park, because the state police was around there, and the man who was in charge of it, they had their own park police, they broke it up right away.
Yeah.
When they run the bunch out of here, they went down there, but they didn't last long, and they're not down there anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
And all the people from up here in Cincinnati, that's where they go for a day. Mm-hmm. They've got a beautiful park there now, and that's where the crowd goes.
Yeah.
And that's the reason. You don't see any foolishness down there.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see a piece, you don't see a cigarette pack on the floor,
mm-hmm.
on the
mm-hmm.
ground.
Mm-hmm.
Everything put in containers right away, and
yeah.
And if they do have it, the state police will come by and tell them to pick it up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they run those hippies out, and those hippies ain't in there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's the way this place could be.
What about maintenance of the park? What would you recommend for that?
Maintenance?
Yeah.
I would say to, like we did years and years ago, they held about, at that time, which we didn't do a whole lot, but we kept the place going and the necessary work, they employed about 4 men year-round.
Mm-hmm. Is that what they have now?
No, they only have... Well, they got these cedar boys, and they keep them because it doesn't cost them much.
Yeah.
But what?
Well, how many does the city itself employ?
Two.
Two, and you're saying that should be at least 4.
At least 4 for the all year round.
I see.
Or maybe 6.
Uh-huh.
And.
And then the cedar they're financed by the cedar program. Yeah.
Yeah, they are. But that's what they need to make this thing go. Of course, you got to have police. Now, you take in winter time, we used to, for the sled riders and ice skaters, we'd either cut dead trees out of the park and cut into fire lengths and provide cans and where they had a fire, and we had that pretty well controlled, same as down by the lake and ice skating.
Oh, they had ice skating in the lake, huh?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. And, that place was covered with people.
Uh-huh.
And we had fire cans down there and plenty of wood. Or, as a matter of fact, they got to burning all the wood so fast that we just bought some coke and used coke instead of wood, which was a lot easier and lasts longer.
But that takes maintenance, doesn't it? I mean,
I'll just have one man. Now, say if it's going to be a nice day, we would fortify these cans. Like we quit at 4 o'clock, we'd fortify them about 3 o'clock, and they would last all
mm-hmm,
night,
mm-hmm,
especially
mm-hmm.
with coke.
Mm-hmm.
And when we did that with the wood, these whoever they were, the sled riders and that, they'd throw all of the wood all around. Just burn it all up, and it's nothing for nobody else.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
That's the reason we quit furnishing wood and went to coke.
Yeah. That's smart. Well, I want to thank you, Mr. Keller, for talking with you and for sharing such an interesting history with us.
Well, I appreciate it. I didn't think I could remember back.
You did a fine job. So, thank you.
So.
Yeah.